workshop. Welcome to this occasion, Economic Rights and Regulatory Regimes. Is there still a right to water? My name is Dennis Galligan, Professor of Sociolegal Studies and a fellow of this college, and also involved very much with the research cluster here at Wolfson. So I'm just going to say a few words of introduction, then I'm going to hand over to Bettina Langer and Mark Shepherd, who will explain a little more some of the themes and ideas that we hope to discuss in the course of the day. I just want to say a word, though, about the three institutions which are involved in organising and sponsoring this workshop. The first is the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which is an independent institution founded in 2005, the main object of which was to make academic research more available to a wider public, particularly the professional, government, business, lawyers and so on, concentrating on the role of law in society. The foundation is based here in the college, and it's associated with the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. So that's the second institution, is the Centre for Sociolegal Studies. Many of you will know about the centre. It's celebrated its 40th birthday last year, and so it is clearly a survivor. It was created just over 40 years ago to encourage the study of law in society and to encourage research into law in society. It was, for the first 21 years, it was funded by the ESRC, and since then it's been funded from various sources. It's a thriving research institution with 30 research students and an academic staff of 10 to 12 full-time researchers. So it is a serious, small but serious and engaged institution within the university. And the foundation is closely associated with the centre. The third institution I won't say much about, Wolfson College, it speaks for itself, a graduate college founded by Isaiah Berlin in the late 1960s. Berlin found the money for the college and then was the first president for 10 years. It's now President Hermione Lee, former professor of English here in Oxford, has really taken the college, I think, to a new and very lively next stage in its existence. It's a large graduate college with roughly 600 students and about 100 fellows and staff. So that's the background. These three institutions have come together at the college to form what we call a research cluster, to be known as Law, Justice and Society at Wolfson. And the idea is to bring people in the college and beyond together from a range of disciplines to discuss broadly issues of law, justice and society. And so finally, I'd just like to thank my colleague, Bettina Langer, who really has organized today's event. It's her ideas and her organization, and also other participants. So I think it'd be best if we introduce each of the speakers as they appear rather than do it at the beginning. But I will now hand over to Bettina, who will introduce herself, and Mark, who will do the same, and they will introduce some of the themes of today's seminar and beyond. Bettina.
Thank you, Dennis. I'm Bettina Lange. I'm a university lecturer in law and regulation at the Center for Sociolegal Studies. And I'd like to extend a very warm welcome to everybody for the workshop here today. And just to say a few things about the ideas we had at the back of our mind for organizing this workshop, we really thought that the question what actually is the meaning and scope of a right to water is becoming increasingly significant, also in the light really of climate change, contributing to extreme weather events that also in the UK have really caused water scarcity and flooding, of course, as well, the much more recent event we see as well currently here in Oxford. And so we have experienced here in the UK water scarcity in 2012, and particularly with the southeast facing severe water shortages. So we thought it would be really timely to organize this workshop now, because the UK government is currently considering reforms for reforming the licensing system for abstracting water, one of the main legal routes through which rights to water are actually acquired. So as far as the law is concerned, a change in what a right to water actually entails is currently being contemplated among policymakers within the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs and the Environment Agency. And the question whether rights to water are really secure is also being opened up by attempts to modify what is essentially a state regulatory system through the dynamics of markets in water, and a point that is currently as well being debated in connection with the draft Water Bill 2012 before the House of Commons. And we thought the workshop is also really timely because in 3 days, on the 22nd of March, World Water Day will be celebrated under the auspices of the UN. And this year's theme is water cooperation. And we may pursue later on today in the discussions in the workshop really the question whether and how rights-based thinking in relation to water can actually facilitate water sharing. So the overarching purpose really of the workshop is to promote discussion about how rights-based thinking about accessing and using water is being transformed, I think, through an increasing recognition of the importance of water stewardship obligations. And the meaning, of course, of water stewardship is really wide-ranging. So here's our starting point.
Yes, good morning. Mark Shepherd. I'm a postdoctoral fellow from McGill University in Montreal. And I was here working on this project with Bettina during last summer and subsequently since then. So it's nice to be back here today to share our findings. Now, as Bettina said, we've been working on water stewardship, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that now as one of our main themes. Stewardship is responsibility to care for property. Historically related to estate management, it finds contemporary expression in the UK with farmer stewardship of the countryside. This includes sustainable abstraction and wise use of water for primary production, protecting the countryside and maintaining scope for future generations' resource use options. It's an active management process for maintaining ecosystem services that recognises farmers as integral to the management of catchment systems and implies responsibility for the state of those systems. The principle underlying water stewardship is for abstractors to recognise water as a form of environmental wealth held in trust and to be managed for the benefit of society. This attempts to provide a stronger sense of personal responsibility for social goals by linking licensed water access and use rights with public good aspirations for the sustainable management of environmental systems. Responsibility is concerned with conduct and its impact upon others. Enabling water stewardship relies on law providing a clear definition of to whom and for what stewardship responsibility is owed. Law and legal institutions can help by specifying rights and positive stewardship obligations for water use entitlements that legally link water users and environmental systems. Importantly, this should not be divorced from local governance settings, since individual water management behaviour is only likely to change when local communities re-establish links with river and catchment systems and the ecosystem services they provide. In this way, multiple benefits can be effectively delivered in the context of stewardship for a particular place. In generic terms, the duties of stewardship have been identified as conservation to keep resources for posterity and preservation to save resources from harm. This is a responsibility for the farmer to demonstrate that social gains are maximised, social costs are reduced, and social risk is minimised in the private use of water, a community asset. Clarity about these responsibilities is necessary so that farmers are not subject to the risk of open-ended and unbounded responsibility for water stewardship.
So in the light of this, we thought kind of it would be interesting to further discuss in the workshop really how the scope and the content of a right to water is potentially changing in the light of increasing regulation, including both regulations through the state, but also market discipline that seeks to align use of water with stewardship obligations. And we are focusing on economic right to water, that is, access to water by those who use water for primary production and whose claims to water are framed sometimes in terms of a property right rather than citizens' claims to domestic water supply framed as a social or political right. While the latter is undoubtedly very important as well, in our view, the fundamental basis of a water regulatory regime is constituted through the claims to raw and treated water made by those who use water for production, that is, industrial and agricultural users, and the water industry itself. And how such claims are legally recognized and framed then also has a bearing on how individual citizens, I think about their right to water. So we structured the day into four panels. In the first one, we're going to be starting off with thinking of how rights-based conception of access to and use of water can be transformed through greater consideration of stewardship obligations. And in the second panel, we want to broaden out the discussion and look at how attempts to introduce greater competition and markets for the supply of water services affirms or detracts from a rights-based way of thinking about accessing water resources. And in the third panel, we have a focus on state regulation, including the EU Water Framework Directive and its implementation in the United Kingdom, and how it seeks to address issues of water scarcity as well. And in the final panel, with a roundtable, we want to finish off by summarizing some key themes from the discussions and having the opportunity as well with a cross-disciplinary audience, and as well having people here who make the regulatory regime actually work, people working for DEFRA, for the Environment Agency, to brainstorm what are further important knowledge gaps and to think what are interesting avenues for future research. And I just want to finish off by thanking really the people from the foundation who made today possible, Judith Niner, Phil Dines, and Amy Richards, for excellent organization of the workshop.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much, Mark and Bettina. We now move into the substantive program. And I'm going to call on Professor Karen Morrow to introduce herself, if you'd like to, Karen, and then give us your presentation.
All right, I'm Karen Morrow. I'm from Swansea University. I am an environmental law professor. I would not describe myself as an expert in water law by any stretch of the imagination. Compared to the rest of the panel, I would say I was paddling in the shallows. But hopefully informatively paddling in the shadows, sometimes coming at things from a slightly different angle can raise interesting questions, I think. So, having been asked to sort of give a paper that sets the scene for water rights, I'm planning to take you time travelling this morning, not just because I live in Cardiff, the home of Doctor Who, but we will go through a couple of centuries and project into the future today, and hopefully come up with some interesting issues about the whole messy, creative, challenging, and I think profoundly important environmental issue that we have here about the nature of rights in the water resource. Now, I do have a PowerPoint so that you have something to look at that is not me. Which is hugely important, but I'm not quite sure how to access it.
Do you want to swap it?
I think I can do it from here.
Would you like to sit here, Karen?
That might be sensible. It's not overly informative. As I say, it's mainly so you have something to look at that isn't me. Try to stick to the point. Right, so whenever Bettina asked me to do this, I thought, well, it sounds really interesting, it's an exciting workshop, but what do I have to say about it? I thought, I don't really know a great deal about water law beyond what I teach to my undergraduate environmental law students. And then I looked at it and realised, but I teach tort as well, and there's quite a lot of water law in tort, as it turns out. And I obviously teach other elements of environmental law, including the intersection between environment and human rights law. And there's a great deal to be said about environmental law and water in that regard. So I thought, yes, I do have something to say here. But what? So I looked at what I knew about water law, and I thought, well, what I see here is a regime that has evolved across human history, certainly in the UK, as an area that is governed more, and has been governed more, by pragmatism than principle. And that is a very natural response to legal problems. That's certainly how the common law tends to proceed generally. But it's one that over time can build up layer upon layer of complexity and become quite problematic, I think, in its own right. So I was thinking about the main areas of law that would be relevant to cover here in one way or another, and I thought, well, yes, obviously there's common law, there's statutory law, there's human rights law. Then I was thinking about the interests that I need to look at, property law as well, and I'm not a property lawyer. The interests, individual interests, obviously, collective interests, and ecological interests, all of these things form part of the regulatory web is probably the right word for it that we apply to water law. It's not as structured as a mosaic. It's a sort of organic system that has grown over time. Not usually, as I say, in any really principled way, and not really with a great deal of thought about how the parts of the regulatory web actually connect to one another, and that can actually cause problems. Looking at water law overall, not just in the UK, but in a global context, which I'll talk about in a minute, I think we've got an area of law here that's got a long history, but a weak pedigree, by which I mean that it's an area that, as I say, has evolved pragmatically rather than on a principled basis, and has got to the stage now where I think in the 21st century we may well need to question its fitness for purpose. It seems to me that what we're looking at now in the area of water generally is a toxic cocktail, as Bettina's rightly referred to, where we have climate change escalating problems that we've already been facing due to population growth and pollution, which we may certainly in Europe have improved in terms of the quantities of polluting effluents that we're actually sending out into the environment, but the toxicity is still an issue. So we've got a finite resource here, which is being placed under unprecedented pressure. Not for the first time in its history, as we'll see a little bit later. The other thing, though, that we've got to take into account, and I think is not at all reflected in any area of our regulatory environment to any adequate degree yet, is our understanding of the hydrological cycle. The water cycle is one of the most complex but least understood aspects of the biosphere. We're gradually gaining knowledge about how it actually operates, but our picture and our understanding, I think, at the minute is still very partial in this regard. So when we are talking about regulating the water resource, we're talking about regulating against a moving background as our knowledge is increasing all the time. But as our knowledge increases as to the complexity of the system, so too do our regulatory challenges of coming up with a way of controlling human interaction with the water resource that's actually viable. So we've got a unique and stressed resource, and water scarcity is an issue in the UK occasionally, but I think probably most people in the UK would look out the window and say, what water scarcity, as they were coming in this morning with the flooding issues. So a stressed resource, I think, maybe gives a better picture of the problems that water is actually facing. Because yes, we do have issues with flooding, we do have issues with scarcity, but we also have a contested resource here that is capable, of course, multiple uses, and then prompts a myriad of potential claims, and those are just three of the areas that are very important: water and property law, water and environmental law, water and human rights law, which I'm going to briefly refer to now on my Cook's tour through some of the important issues. I would say I'm proceeding by means of a number of snapshots rather than an attempt to be comprehensive. That's not possible in a subject with this long and this complex a history, but things that give a flavour of what's going on. So the context that we're talking about here, obviously the right to water debate in international human rights law is a big issue here. It's not something I'm going to talk about in any detail at all, because it's quite far divorced from what we're looking at in the rest of the workshop today, but it's something to be aware of. And the right to water debate there, as Bettina rightly referred to, is the more typical individual, social, indeed survival right, if you take it to its absolute basics. It's a very contested area in international law. It's also contested in domestic law. South Africa's constitution, of course, gives a right to water, but that's been hugely problematic in case law. And I would direct your attention to the Piri litigation if you have an interest in seeing how substantive water rights claims play out in the courts and what their limits are. Then there's also, as I say, the environmental, the ecological perhaps content text and the newish thinking on planetary boundaries of which water forms a part. The planetary boundaries work coming out of Stockholm has selected 9 areas where the environment is particularly under stress and where we are either close to or have already past the point where we can actually look to our behaviour as being in any way sustainable in the long term. Water is one of these resources, and it was Professor Will Steffen from the Planetary Boundaries Project who's done most work in the water area, and he selected one water indicator, because it's a very graphic indicators-based project, as the canary in the cage, if you like, for water issues, water resources issues more generally, and that's blue water consumption, which is fresh water diverted for human consumption. Currently, we're on about 4,000 kilometres cubed a year as consumption, currently we're on 3,000 kilometres cubed a year consumption. The stress area begins at 4,000 kilometres cubed, and the boundary will be passed at between 5 and 6 kilometres cubed. So using this canary in the cage approach, they're saying that water consumption, just this one indicator, there are other more complex things that are more difficult to measure. This was selected as being measurable. We're approaching the safe boundary for sustainable human activity. We're not there yet, but we're within sight of it. That tells us a couple of things. There's still time to do something about it, but it is a pressing issue. There are other areas that are much worse, I have to admit. Biodiversity, we're already exceeding the boundaries in that, for example. But looking at these debates, the human rights debates, the ecological debates about viable and sustainable human interaction with the biosphere, water law is not keeping pace with our understanding of these issues. It's not keeping pace with our understanding of what a right to water might mean and how it may be something that is contentious but certainly debatable as a basic human entitlement, not taking into account as well the need to regulate consumption overall. The regime that we have to tackle all of this at the minute, as I see it, is fragmented, in parts archaic, and certainly always opaque. Water law, I think, has, in terms of environmental law anyway, I would see it as being pretty much a poor relation. It doesn't have the profile it deserves. Certainly in the UK, I think that's because we've always had the luxury of not having to worry too much about it. It's a relatively plentiful resource in most parts of the UK, the southeast being a very big exception here. And the pattern has always been in the UK, certainly since the 19th century in environmental regulation, that we deal with the problems that we can see first. We're not the most imaginative species when it comes to regulation. We deal with what's most pressing. This is an issue that's going to become most pressing. The question, I suppose, for us at the minute is, do we have the foresight to actually grasp the nettle and deal with it before it becomes very pressing? We shall see. So, what about these rights? Well, I could talk about any number of rights that exist in terms of the water resources. Fisheries rights, as in British Celanese and Hunt, in nuisance. Public nuisance rights to navigation, as in the Tate and Lyle Industries litigation. But those are tangential, to my view, to the main issues. There are two that I've selected to focus on today. Riparian rights to extraction and riparian rights in respect of pollution, because I think they're most directly concerned with the type of stewardship issues that we'll be looking at in more detail lately. Now, in terms of riparian rights, these roots are rooted in Roman law, so my choice of crossing the Rubicon as a title wasn't accidental, more fortuitous, I think. And essentially, riparian rights in UK law, following on from that base, are an adjunct to property, specifically to land law. And they involve not the ownership of water, but usufruct rights where water is concerned. So the right to put water to use for your own purposes. Certainly in the Victorian period, when a lot of those prominent litigation came to the fore in terms of extraction rights, which I'll talk about first, the courts and the judges were very, very determined to parallel a right to extract water to land law concepts like an easement giving you a right of way. And that proved particularly important in the extraction context, and I think ultimately rather problematic. In terms of extraction and easements, the courts tended to the view that comparing extraction to a right of way, intensification of your use did not affect the easement. So you could intensify your use over years. This was discussed in the case of Cargill and Gotts, referring to Millington and Griffiths from 1874. And in terms of extraction, intensification, they decided was not important if ultimately even the intensified extraction had no material effect on the stream. Now, at that point, measuring material effect on a stream would be very much a case of going and looking at it. Not the most advanced way of doing it. We would now be much more careful, I think, in measuring material effects. But interestingly, so they were saying for extraction, intensification had no material effect on the stream and therefore no implications for your easement. But right from the beginning, even at that period, they were treating extraction differently from pollution. So in Cargill and Gotts, again, referring back to the Millington case, they were saying that if you're talking about a prescriptive right to pollute a stream, you must show for a 20-year period that you've introduced polluting matter of a kind and quantity which produces on the effect on the stream which you claim to be entitled to. So intensification for pollution would actually extinguish your easement because you were going beyond the kind and quantity of what you had actually been claiming in the first place. I'm not sure that, and the better water lawyers in the area will tell me whether they think that's justified, but I'm not sure that I feel comfortable with those two things being treated so distinctly on this point in terms of intensification, particularly given that flow issues can, of course, intensify polluting effects in their own right if you extract too much. Nonetheless, the courts worked out a working orthodox view on extraction, specifically Lord Cairns' statement in Swindon Waterworks, as approved by the House of Lords, particularly in Lord McNutton's obiter dictum in Macartney and Lough Swilly Railway. And unfortunately, my throat is dry because I'm probably one of the few people in the room who can pronounce an Irish loch properly, not like a Scottish loch. So it's a case I enjoy for that reason, if that reason alone. But anyway, extraction really was broken down into three possibilities. For ordinary or primary purposes, domestic use, watering your cattle, etc., you were talking about a right that was without restriction. Now, that on the face of it doesn't look as if it has much in the line of to offer in stewardship. If you can take water without restriction, what's to stop you from taking so much from the stream that you harm users downstream? And on the face of it, that looked like a very, very strong individualistic approach until you realise that actually the courts interpreted that very narrowly. And basically, once you got into the realm of industrial agriculture, particularly with things like spray irrigation, the courts would not regard that as an ordinary or primary purpose. Instead, they would put it into the second category here. They would use it as define it as an extraordinary or secondary purpose, and the controls there were much more stringent. So for extraction for extraordinary or secondary purposes, that extraction had to be reasonable, it had to be connected directly with the riparian land, and the water had to be restored to the watercourse substantially undiminished in volume and unaltered in character. So in early cases involving spray regulation in the late 1900s, it was already being characterised as an extraordinary or a secondary use, depending on the circumstances. It was certainly capable of being so categorised. And the courts then were talking about a much more relative right to extract. The third category involved extracting for purposes foreign to or unconnected with the riparian tenement, and there were no rights here at all for landowners. So that was the traditional approach. And the common law was placing limitations on riparian rights extractions as a matter of fact and a matter of interpretation. And the Rugby and Joint Water Board and Walters case is a later example of following that through, but looking at spray irrigation. Statutory limitations also began to take an effect on riparian extraction rights, and obviously in a much more widespread way, particularly under the regime introduced by the Water Act 1963. And there's a very interesting case that arose under this in Ettrick Trout Company and the Secretary of State for the Environment and the NRA in 1995. And it shows exactly the sort of nexus, I think, that we're talking about today. In this case, ETC had a 20-year lease running from 1981, which included a private law right to extract water from the river for their fish farm. The lease, as is common, didn't place any limit on the amount of water that could be extracted. It did, however, contain a covenant requiring ETC to observe the limits and conditions that were contained in a discharge consent that also related to the fish farm, which had been set up in 1978. Now, under this discharge consent, they could release 10 million gallons a day of effluent into the river. However, the fish farm had the capacity to extract 20 million gallons of water from the river per day, and it had done that right from the start. And obviously, if it was extracting 20 million gallons of water a day from the river, it was emitting 20 million gallons of water back into the river after the water had flowed through the fish farm, which meant that it was in breach of its discharge consent from the first. And it was actually prosecuted for this in 1990. That secured an injunction, and in 1991, prosecuted again, this time with a conviction. They tried to appeal it, but they were unsuccessful. Now, in terms of the extraction issue, the Water Act 1989 required people in ETC's position to apply to the National Rivers Authority, as the regulator then was, to extract water. They didn't need a license as such, but they needed to effectively register their consumption, what they'd consumed before, as a matter of right under the legislation. So whenever they sought authorization for their abstraction level, the National Rivers Authority said, well, you can only extract 10 million gallons a day because that's all you're authorised to emit at the other end. The fish farm contested this. It went to an inquiry where the inspector found that their 20 million gallons extraction was established and recommended that the licence should allow that quantity. Interestingly saying, unless harmful effects to the river could be taken into consideration. And if harmful effects to the river could be taken into consideration, he decided that it would be appropriate to go with the NRA's 10 million gallons a day figure. So the inspector was pro granting them their license. The Secretary of State disagreed. The Secretary of State thought that he should be entitled to take into account the discharge consent, and also that only lawful extraction could be a valid consideration for this authorization process, and the courts agreed with him on that point. So we have a very indirect way of limiting extraction here, with reference not to extraction itself in the first place, but actually to emissions or throughput in the end, which is, I think, quite interesting. Not hugely well thought through, and could be better described, but interesting. Cargill and Gotts, I'm not going to go into in any detail because I'm conscious of the passage of time. It's not a riparian rights case as such, because the plaintiff here was extracting water from a neighbour's mill pond. However, I will just comment on one aspect of the case. In this case, the plaintiff had been extracting water from this mill pond since the 1920s, so he had gained an easement, he had a legal right to do so. One of the questions, though, was what effect the passing of the 1963 Water Resources Act had on his easement. Because what the 1963 Act did was subject to certain exceptions, effectively for de minimis abstraction. It was that it made it illegal to extract water from any source of supply without a license. And what the Court of Appeal had to say about this was interesting. They said that he couldn't rely on post-1963 content because conduct because he'd been abstracting illegally in large part after that point. But that he did have an easement that ran from before 1963 and that was relevant. His easement remained. However, he would only be able to exercise it when he obtained a license under the statute. And he would only be able to exercise his easement in accordance with the terms of that statute. So they said, in short, the easement remains an easement, but cannot be exercised without committing an offence under the statute. A very clear indication that whatever the common law rights of riparian extraction were, they are now very strongly subject to statute in most cases beyond a certain minimum threshold. Now, the water bill, as Bettina mentioned, is actually looking again, or supposed to be looking again, at some modernisation in this regard. And for me as an environmental lawyer, some of the things that are proposed in the bill, and subsequently, because a few of them have been put on the long finger, are integrating water abstraction and some other issues more closely with environmental law through integrating it into the environmental permitting regime. That, as I say, is interesting because it seems to bring water law more squarely, or this aspect of water law more squarely, within the remit of environmental law in the mainstream. However, having had a quick look at the white paper, the rationale for doing this isn't environmental as far as I can see. It seems to be based on administrative convenience and achieving administrative coherence. And in fact, having been in this game for a very long time, it reminds me very strongly of a lot of the material that was coming out before integrated pollution control was introduced, with the one-stop shop for industry being the guiding principle behind this. And that wasn't something I thought I'd see. It's not in quite such bold terms, but it's very much the singing from the same hymn sheet as that, shall we say. There are another couple of interesting things in the background to the water bill that, as an environmental lawyer, worry me, and something I'd like to flag up maybe for us to think about later, is the desire to make the promotion of sustainable development one of Ofwat's primary duties rather than it is now a secondary duty. Ofwat is not keen. They think this could unbalance the sector and risks increasing bills and decreasing investment. That I find quite worrying and quite short-termist as an approach to developing a sustainable approach to the water resource and to abstraction. And I don't have time to do more than touch on it there here because I need to move on. In terms of pollution, of course, individual rights have a lot to say here. The basic principle from Young and Bankier Distillery is that you have a right to water that's not just the same in flow as it is upstream, but also of a like quality. The law has touched on many aspects of private rights in this area with greater or less success. Cambridge Water dealt with groundwater and historic pollution, and effectively this case paralysed the common law in terms of historic pollution because it said that there would only be liability for damage that was foreseeable at the time when spills of chemicals occurred to a reasonable site foreman. Now, for any of you who are familiar with environmental regulatory regimes, that's very low down the food chain for looking at reasonable foreseeability. In legislative approaches, we don't look at the person in the boiler suit who's spilling the chemicals. We look at the controlling mind of the company and the environmental management. So here, the common law, I think, is out of step with statutory regime, and foreseeability is limited here. Transco shows, despite Cambridge Water, we're still alive and well in terms of Rylands and Fletcher liability in water. But on a very limited modern incarnation. Now, human rights claims are starting to appear in the water sector. Mark Church and Thames Water Utility, probably the most controversial, dealing with inadequate sewerage services provided by Thames Water. Mark Church had a statutory claim under the Water Industry Act, which he did not take. Instead, he brought a combined action in nuisance negligence under the rule in Rylands and Fletcher, a claim in breach of statutory duty, and a claim under the Human Rights Act. His Human Rights Act claim succeeded at first instance, everything else failed. His nuisance and Human Rights Act claims succeeded in the Court of Appeal. Thames Water appealed to the House of Lords, who overturned everything that had gone before and basically said that a combination of common law and human rights was not going to be allowed to displace a settled statutory regime that had been put in place. Excuse me, it's late in the semester and my voice is going.
You'll be winding up fairly.
Yeah, that had been put in place to deal with it. Tobson dealt with issues of the overlap between claims in nuisance and claims in human rights, not very satisfactorily. The most important case, though, in the relationship between individual rights and in nuisance, particularly in regulation, has been Biffa, Bar and Biffa Waste Services, which was recently in the Court of Appeal and which we believe will go further. And in ultimately upholding nuisance claims about the operation of a landfill site, Lord Justice Cunworth made the comments that you can see before you on the screen. I'm not going to go through them because, one, my voice is running out, and two, I'm running out of time. They're available on the website. But basically saying that regulatory law does not, without explicit authority in any way, cut down common law rights. Huge and controversial area, and one that I'm not sure has been fully resolved, and indeed think requires to be fully resolved. Last, something to chew on. We've talked about human rights, we've talked about rights for humans, now I want to talk about rights for nature. There's much more radical thinking afoot on the rights regime at the minute, and we have had in domestic law in South America, for example, Ecuador's constitution in 2008, rights for nature, Bolivia's law of the rights of Mother Earth in 2010. We've also had action by international civil society in this area with the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Mother Earth in Cochabamba in Bolivia in 2010. Even the UN has actually looked at rights for nature in its own intergovernmental negotiation process on harmony with nature and introducing International Mother Earth Day. All very touchy-feely. How much of an impact does it have? Well, that's another question for another day. But more specifically here, what about rights for rivers? And this is something much more interesting that's happening, I think, in New Zealand at the minute, where in 2012, the Whanganui River, which is the third longest in New Zealand, was accorded legal personality in an agreement under the Treaty of Waitangi by the Whanganui River Māori and the New Zealand government. The Māori have been trying to get protection for this river since 1873, so this is not a flash in the pan. They weren't asserting ownership claims, but they wanted protection for the river, which in this context they referred to as Te Awa Tupua. This means, not quite literally, but in its sense, it means it's an integrated living whole. So they wanted the river protected as an integrated living whole. Full details of what this will mean for the river are still being finalised, but the government has said that its position will be something akin to that of a company in terms of its legal personality, which I think is quite interesting. The agreement, on the other hand, is quite clear so far about what it won't do. It won't create water rights, and it won't affect the rights of existing riparian owners. What it does do is ensure that the river can't be owned. So, finishing where I began, I suppose. Nice cycle, if we're talking about the water cycle. Do we need to look seriously at water law and how we regulate it? Yes. Do we need to look seriously at the interaction between individual rights and other aspects of water law? Yes. Do we maybe need to do something a bit more radical in light of planetary boundaries? Yes, I think we do. Is the die cast, since we're talking about the Rubicon? No, not yet. We're not at the point of no return in terms of planetary boundaries. Not yet, but we will get there soon. And by the time I concluded that, I needed a bit of cheering up, so this was the funniest image I could find of any Romans crossing the Rubicon. I think they're little models from the Asterix series, which takes me back a long way to Latin books at school. So there's a lot to think about here. The law domestically has been shifting. It's never involved absolute rights for individuals in any meaningful sense. They've always been curtailed by the needs of others. The discussion in other arenas is moving on to whether we actually need to curtail our rights more strongly, taking into account a more biospheric approach and looking at the possibility, radical as it may seem, of rights for the resource that we're trying to protect or interact with in a meaningful level. And I think I'm just within my half hour.
Thank you very much, Carol. Well, Bettina, we'll go straight on to you, and then we'll have some questions and answers and comments at the end of Bettina's presentation.
Right, I guess our presentation follows on in thinking about rights, not so much in a legal context, but in sort of thinking about it from a social legal perspective, in sort of seeing how key actors really in a regulatory regime think about their right to water, how they conceptualize the very idea of a right to water. So our title actually picks up on two key terms that were being used by the interview respondents in our study, vanity vegetables and quarry farming. And there were terms that people were using in order to refer to pressures that exist on potentially unsustainable use of water at the farm. So that vanity vegetables refer to the fact that there can be pressure from supermarkets to water the vegetables quite a bit in order to get a nice finish to market them more successfully on the supermarket shelf. And quarry farming was an idea that very short-term farm leases could be a barrier towards more sustainable use of water on the farm. We're going to be talking about that sort of more in the actual presentation. So what we actually did is that we thought it would be interesting when looking at the literature on natural resource stewardship. There are a number of unresolved questions, and a key question as well is the issue how well private property rights really can protect common pool resources, water being one of them. And what we wanted to do is to say, before sort of engaging into that further normative debate, it would be really interesting to take a step back and address the analytical issue of seeing kind of how people operate in these regulatory regimes and operate in these legal frameworks, how they actually think about their right to water. Because sort of coming from a theoretical framework as well that starts from the idea that and how legal governance mechanisms for water work depends a lot as well on how the stakeholders on the ground actually make meaning out of the legal provisions that are there and how they fill them in their own thinking and their own interactions with their ideas about what the right to water actually entails. So the key question that we were asking for this pilot project is, how is an economic right to water actually conceptualized, and what drives these conceptions? And so we started off by seeing as well that we get various different types of rights conceptions, and Karen's presentation as well sort of already referred to that as well. So we can usually start off with a binary between administrative rights, kind of the idea that in a number of jurisdictions really as well, we may think of water as being nearly nationalized as a resource in the sense that lawful access usually is only possible under a statutorily granted license, lawful access. And then we also have private property rights as well as very important historically, but also in very innovative contemporary regimes. So we can think about a private property conception of a right to water being created from the common law, for example, in debates about the question whether groundwater under a piece of land is actually part of the land ownership. We can think about the source of private property rights as well coming from modern human rights protection, such as from Article 1 and the first protocol to the European Convention of Human Rights. And we can also think about quasi-property rights being created through interesting modern statutory regimes that create entitlements in water in order to be able to trade water in markets and achieve efficient allocation. And as Karen mentioned as well, kind of another sort of meaningful distinction in this area in thinking about different types of rights is a distinction between individual private property rights, for example, being characterized by the three key characteristics of being able to exclude others from the enjoyment of the thing, being able to transfer the right, and being able to enforce these rights that go with it against others. But also the idea that sometimes individual rights become further buttressed when people, particularly, for example, people who use water for primary production, band together and assert collective rights to water. And so while kind of the initial distinction between administrative rights and private property rights is helpful to start unpacking how we can fill the notion of rights with meaning in this context, there's also interesting writing kind of that says, well, the two aren't sort of really very binary, because in a very interesting article from Charles Reich, for example, he asserted the idea that what we are seeing in modern welfare and regulatory states is such significant dispense of largesse, for example, so granting licenses that enable groups then to conduct their livelihood under those licenses, or as well kind of to some of the examples referred to the social security state, that the kind of provision of these rights kind of for modern states is so extensive and so significant that they have become a quasi type of property right that he makes an argument as well should be significantly protected. So there's a question whether we shouldn't be thinking really about these administrative rights under licenses, for example, to abstract water, not so much as very distinct, but as a form of new property. And then, of course, there's thinking as well beyond the very idea of soft rights talk. And here we are sort of picking up on the idea of common pool resource receptions of water. And these really don't foreground entitlements to water, but instead emphasize limits to individual control or even ownership of water, given the free-flowing nature of water and the hydrological cycle. And they therefore think about access to and use of water not so much in terms of a right to a specific allocation of water, but more in terms of individuals sharing into the use and guardianship of a common pool resource that is a traditional public good and thus beyond being owned. So what we did is to set up a case study design that included two case studies, the purpose of which was to map how we are particularly focusing on farmers, think about a right to water and identify key factors that shape such conceptions. And we're focusing on farmers because in terms of overall amount of water that they abstract, they're not the biggest abstractors in the UK. The water companies abstract bigger volumes. But they hold actually the greatest number of licenses. So in terms of being a significant regulated population, being really very key in terms of becoming subject to as well in some ways increasing scrutiny on their use of water. And also we thought it would be really interesting to focus on farmers because there's a whole history in terms of how they have been regulated in the UK as well, and trying to enroll them as being guardians of the countryside. So there's a long history of environmental stewardship programs, for example, that have been run by Natural England and that seek to minimize pollution that farmers as well have contributed to, for example, so nitrate runoff, pesticide runoff from land. So the two contrasting exploratory case studies were chosen in order to ensure significant amount of variation of factors that we thought might be relevant for driving conceptions of a right to water. So we have one case study in a water-rich region in the northeast, which is characterized by abstraction to a limited amount for agricultural purposes, other types of extractions as well being quite important in that area, and as well, of course, being characterized by water abundance, and as well, therefore, kind of being subject to a limited amount of regulatory intervention. For example, the Restoring Sustainable Abstraction Program that is run by the Environment Agency in order to tackle water scarcity by reviewing licenses There are only five of those programs running in the Northeast area. In contrast to the water scarce area, Anglia, that we looked at as a contrast, where there are about 70 of these schemes, are an area with significantly more regulatory intervention, with significant obstruction, in particular for agricultural production, and as well significant pressure on protection of habitats in the Anglia region. So what we generated from the data that we got is really qualitative empirical data. We had interviews with 12 key stakeholders, two farmers in each of the case study regions, with one regulator in each of the regions, and with representatives of farmers themselves, and as well representatives of civil society becoming involved in developing stewardship obligations, i.e. representatives of river trusts and river trust-like organizations. And we looked at key public policy documents and relevant legislation. And so what was important to us is really develop as well through this data what we're calling an eco-social legal perspective, which means that we consider conceptions of the social world, which are visible in legal, institutional, as well as economic factors, as well as perceptions of the natural world, expressed in perceptions of geographical space, as relevant for explaining how conceptions of a right to water are actually changing. And so we are seeking to avoid either sociological or ecological determinism. And hence, we perceive the notion of a right to water not merely as the outcome of interests staked and claims made in political struggles over access to and use of water, but as constituted also through the discursive power of legal and spatial geographical categories. So what does a right to water actually mean to farmers? One of the key interesting findings of our research is that stewardship isn't really an isolated idea there that sort of in a quite distinct way sort of qualifies the idea of a right to water. We clearly saw key stakeholders, including farmers, asserting a distinct right to water. But we saw that as sort of becoming intricately linked and transformed by being connected to awareness about stewardship obligations. And the focus of our study is really to focus on water quantity as a sort of more recent and in some ways less researched issue than water pollution issues that as well have received more attention so far. So we're saying that there's a hybrid right stewardship conception of a right to water, and we can see this, first of all, on a discursive level, which is kind of that we got accounts of what the right to water means that said water conservation is seen as part and parcel of running an efficient farm business. And the running the efficient farm business was further anchored into private property conceptions and being linked to a right to farm, and as well being linked to rights to recoup investment and get returns on investments that have been already made in labor, into irrigation equipment, into running the farm. But we see this as well, I think, in a very internal structural level in the regulatory system, the legal institutional framework, where we're seeing administrative rights to water becoming qualified to stewardship conceptions. So at the same time as the regulatory regime is creating distinct administrative rights to water, it is qualifying them integrally through stewardship conceptions. Oops. So what we're going to do as well is say a few things then about the three key factors, our second key finding that we identified as being relevant for driving the development of hybrid right stewardship conceptions. And first of all, very interestingly, we've seen that grain production and consumption standards, expressed, for example, through voluntary farm product issuance schemes and contractual relationships with supermarkets, have a bearing on how one fleshes out the notion of a right to water. And I'll just hand over here to Mark.
Thank you, Bettina. So what we're talking about here are assurance.